As the world grapples with an extinction crisis, the threat of global climate change, exponential population growth and intractable poverty and inequality, scientist and author Tim Flannery is mounting what he calls an argument for hope. It's the key theme of his 17th book, it's called Here on Earth, which charts a history of life on our planet right up to this current century of crisis. Tim Flannery joins you this morning in our breakfast studio. Tim, thanks very much for joining us again.
It's a great pleasure.
You say this is the century of crisis, especially for the climate. What do you mean? Why is this century in particular?
Sure, look, this is the century where human population is going to peak about 40 years from now. It's something like 9 billion people. It's a century when we're going to have to face a food crisis to feed those people. It's also the century where water is going to become the absolute key issue for a lot of development. It's also the century of the climate crisis. We will either succeed at reducing our greenhouse gas emissions over this century or we'll fail, and that's a defining moment for humanity. It's also the century of the biodiversity crisis. We're seeing species go extinct at a faster rate than ever before. So this is it. We're at the beginning now of the great transition. And of course, on top of all of that, humanity is making a fundamental shift from a group of nations into something perhaps a little bit bigger.
As you say all that, I feel less hopeful, not more. Why do you remain hopeful?
Well, I guess I felt a bit like you do now a few years ago when I started just taking on board the enormous challenge that humanity faces. And the only way I could make sense of it really was to take a long-term view, to go right back and see, and to ask those fundamental questions. What are we as a species? You know, are we a species that's forged in the evolutionary process as something that is a survival of the fittest type organism or something different? And I think if you take that longer term view, you do see that people do have the capacity to make the accommodations that are required to live sustainably. And we can see that at small scale and at large scale. We can see it in the development of our civilization and in some of our recent triumphs. And we've been very good with some things.
So in sense, in the book, you start with Darwin, you start with evolution, and you go to the Gaia theory. And it seems to be, you're arguing that we will survive, we will make the required decisions because of the history of evolution, the survival of the fittest. Evolution means survival. To survive, we need to start working together.
Yeah, I guess so. That's one way of putting it. See, what I really think is that the competition is the evolution's forge. That's what creates us. But the legacy of that competition is always cooperation. We live in a huge society that's a result of cooperation. And cooperation really means giving something away, giving some real power away to others. And all of us are now so interdependent that we can't live as we did 10,000 years ago. It's just no longer possible. And as we move forward, we're going to have to become ever more interdependent.
But as that interdependence involves more and more people, more and more billions of people, and the world is not so orderly in terms of broken down into smaller states, it's, as you say, this sort of, well, globalisation is what we're talking about. We've never really faced such a complex time. I mean, aren't you worried that that complexity might mean we might not connect in the way we have in the past to make these crucial decisions?
Sure, it's always possible we'll fail, but I think I can see a lot of reasons for thinking that we'll actually make this transition. We've done it all before at smaller scale, and when I look at my children now and the way they live and the way they use the internet and the way they have friends overseas, you see that the nations are becoming less important. That basic humanist ideal, that we're all valuable, you know, we're all important, is taking root. And I think we do have the capacity to make that transition.
I think most people listening would think there's no doubt we have the capacity, but do we have the leadership and the political will? And we only need to look back as far as December at Copenhagen at the climate summit to look at that failure of political will and leadership and determination.
I strongly disagree, Fran, that it was a failure. I think that process was incredibly valuable. No. I mean, as a result of that process, not just the meeting, take the 3 years leading up to it, and I was chair of the Copenhagen Climate Council through that time, you know, we saw a fundamental transition in the way that China and India and other developing countries view this problem. The start of that process, they said, no, we're not going to do anything. You created the problem. You fix it. Today, China is poised to invest $750 billion in the next 4 decades in clean technology. In the next 5 years, they'll be introducing their own carbon trading scheme, and they've set the most aggressive targets pretty much anywhere for the reduction in emissions.
With its own self-interest at heart.
That's absolutely right. And self-interest is a very important part of this. You know, but where our self-interest coincides with the common interest, that's where we make progress.
Sure, there was self-interest on display at Copenhagen. Even Ivo de Boer admitted Copenhagen was a failure in that we didn't come up with the crucial targets. I mean, there is a time limit on this. As you said, this is the century of crisis. Mm. These decisions, this self-interest needs to be turbocharged, doesn't it?
Look, what Copenhagen did was give us about two-thirds of the emissions reductions we need to avoid dangerous climate change. So we're two-thirds of the way there. We've got to pick up that other third. And that can only come from the developed countries committing to greater emissions reduction targets. So Europe needs to go from its 20% target now down to minus 30% by 2020. Australia needs to increase its ambition from a 5% decrease to something like a 15% or more decrease. And USA needs to do the same. And if we do that, we will actually achieve. We will avoid dangerous climate change.
Your optimism is based on our basic intelligence, human beings' basic intelligence, isn't it? I think you said last night on the 7:30 report, we are the intelligence of the world, did you say?
Yeah, we're the intelligence of the world, but what is more important is our capacity to love and empathise. That is what's really at the heart of all of this. If we lack that, we will fail. We need to trust each other to move forward and to give something away as we move forward. It's the only way that humanity has ever progressed.
Love and trust and belief. This book from you, the scientist, is peppered with that kind of language. Is this a development in the way you're thinking, or do you see this book as less a book of science and more a book of belief?
I've begun to think I've misunderstood the scientific process. The reductionist science that I've practiced all of my life is very good for answering small questions. But you know, I learnt as I looked at the climate problem that we can't use reductionist science to examine that system. We have to create a model world, a virtual world, which is what the computer models do. And those model worlds are actually very much like theatre or literature, novels, where we create a kind of a model of the world we live in and then vary some of the aspects of it. And we can, you know, watch a play or we can look at a computer model. When you're dealing with complex systems, that's what you need to do. So this book is, in a sense, a synthesis of those approaches.
There is a chapter in the book headed Greed and the Market, and that reminded me of a book called Capitalism as If the World Matters, a book by Jonathan Porritt. We interviewed him on Breakfast some years ago when he put out the book, which basically his thesis, let me quote him, says, embracing capitalism as the only overarching system capable of achieving any kind of reconciliation between ecological sustainability on the one hand and the pursuit of prosperity and personal well-being on the other. In other words, he says capitalism, we have to embrace it, go with it. That's mm-hmm. the only way through this. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, I agree with it. It's capitalism with the appropriate rules in place. The market, there's a very strong argument that the marketplace is what made us. It's where we first learned to trust, to trade. And, you know, the market is the only system where you get a win-win. Prior to that, someone would bang someone else over the head and steal something, and that was a win-lose. The market allows both people to feel that they're winners. Fundamentally important, but it has to be hedged in by rules that are protect people and protect the environment.
It's 14 past 8 on Breakfast. Our guest this morning is Tim Flannery, and his new book, his 17th book, not bad, is called Here on Earth, An Argument for Hope. Tim, at what point in this century of crisis as you've called it, will we know as humankind that we've switched to saving the planet, not destroying it?
The first big hurdle is going to be about 2015 or thereabouts. If places like Australia and the US haven't started to turn down their emissions curve by then, we'll be in serious trouble, because it gets ever harder after that to start to avoid dangerous climate change. So we have to see a reduction in our emissions at that point.
So it's all about climate change. That's the first indicator, the canary in the coal mine. Because you also write about, you know, toxic chemicals and our
sure.
capacity to pollute our own nest.
That's right. That's one. The second is we have to start dealing with these environmental pollutants, not just the toxic chemicals, but some of the metals and so forth. You know, if you go to Mount Isa today, you'll see a population where 10% of the children have lead poisoning, unacceptably high levels of lead in their blood, and that is unacceptable in itself, those sort of outcomes. So we have to actually, as I said, civilise the market, make sure that companies are fully responsible for the pollutants that they put into the atmosphere and into our bodies.
Let's switch gear now and come back domestically and to the domestic political situation we're in at the moment. Why did Kevin Rudd, as Prime Minister, fail to deliver on what he called the great moral challenge of our times? And what's the lesson in that failure? I mean, you say Copenhagen was a success, but it, in a sense, led to a failure here in Australia.
We committed under the Copenhagen Accord to the minus 5%. What we failed to do was deliver a mechanism that would allow us to achieve that. And that was the emissions trading scheme we needed. I think that there was a failure of courage. I think that Kevin Rudd, his courage failed him when he saw that there was going to be a struggle on. And that is really regrettable. And the consequences of that for Kevin really were that he lost the trust of the people of Australia. And trust is the only commodity that, that politicians have to trade in, really. Unless we trust them, whatever they say or do is meaningless.
Given the current political landscape, do you see any prospect of achieving action on climate change with this minority government?
I'd be a lot happier if Greg Combe was the Minister for Climate Change and Energy instead of just energy efficiency, because it's the energy system you need to change in order to address climate change. And so while we still have Martin Ferguson as the Minister for Energy, the man who believes that coal is the future, we're going to have a struggle.
Martin Ferguson, nevertheless, has in recent days been talking about the necessity of a price on carbon. We've had the head of BHP Billiton, Marius Kloppers, talking about the need for a price on carbon. Do you sense a change, a shift in the messages coming out?
Sure, there is a shift, but we've got to get the political reality lined up with that, and that is, you know, energy and climate change are just two sides of the one coin. They need to be together. In European countries, we see that. You know, with those responsibilities twinned, we're not yet seeing it in Australia, and I read that as a reluctance on the part of this government to move forward. Doesn't mean they won't, it's just going to be more difficult, and that there is still there's still a divide in the party.
Would you accept, in fact, are you looking for an invitation to join the government's climate change committee?
I don't know what I'd do on it. Look, you know, the thing is they've modelled this on a parliamentary committee, and it should be smaller than the cabinet, obviously, that's going to report to. So you don't want too many people on it and too many voices. I think you'd, you know, half a dozen key players from the major political parties would really do the job and call people like me in to testify before them.
External advisor will definitely be part of it.
Yeah, well, I guess so, something like that. But anyway...
You're not putting your hand up necessarily.
No, if they want me to do it, I'd be happy to do it. But look, there's a lot of people and there's very few seats around that table. So I just hope the country gets that mix right and we do get a small, very active and capable group who can drive that forward and build the consensus, the political view that's needed.
There you go again. You see, you're still talking about hope. That's a good thing. Tim Flannery, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Fran.
Scientist and author and former Australian of the Year, Tim Flannery. And his new book, Here on Earth, is published next week, published by Text, Here on Earth, An Argument for Hope. It's 8:18.